Hi, everybody. I'm Debbie Richards, and I'm an alcoholic. Thanks, George, for a very nice introduction. I want to thank the committee for inviting me to Mont Eagle. I've heard so much about it. This and a few other conventions, retreats, are like the mecca of the old-timers, and to be invited to share is an honor beyond belief, and I just really, really thank you so much for inviting me to speak up here. I have an important announcement too. For all of you Dallas fans, which I am one of, we are taping Dallas tonight. And we'll be seen about 9:45 in that great big room with the TV. Thanks to Jerry, Mac, and JR, we're gonna get it taped tonight. I know. Some addictions are worse than others, you know. And I'm one of them. So, anyway, that's important news, and everybody can relax now. You don't have to worry about missing Dallas. Just to give you some background on me, I am a member of the Skyland Group, and I know that Jerry Mack and Harold are members of my home group. I think they were sent here to make sure I stay honest and give the full report back in Atlanta. And as far as I know, those are the only members from Skyland, and I'm very proud to be a member of Skyland and a member in good standing there. And it's been my home group since I moved to Atlanta just a little over 5 years ago. I'm single. I've never been married. I have 4 babies, though. However, these babies are furry and meow, and anybody who'd like to see their pictures after the meeting, I'll be glad to show you. I'm 27, and my sobriety date is February 8, 1976, which means that in February I had my 9th anniversary. I'm 5'5", and the rest of those numbers are none of your business. a lot of people say to me, "Aren't you glad that you got in when you were young?" And I am. I'm very glad. I'm glad I didn't have to look like an alcoholic to belong here. I'm glad that I could wear a watch and not be told that I hadn't drank long enough. No one ever said to me, "You're too young." Now, I tried to convince them of that, but no one ever said that to me. If they did, I never heard it. And, you know, I didn't hear many things in those days, and that was one of the things I didn't hear. But I'm very glad that the way I look at my alcoholism is that when I had that first drunk at 12 years old, and 5 years later I was being taken to a hospital for alcoholism and drug addiction, God sort of said, "Well, you're going to go through this, but we're going to move along quickly. I mean, we're not going to take 20 years to get there because I have other things for you to do." And I don't know what those other things are, but I find I am always more and more ready to go and to do and to be whatever he needs. And that's the way I look at it. Those who took longer, you know, you just have your own things to do, and you had those things to do while you were drinking. But that's how I look at it. Yes, I'm very grateful, because I know that I can't see, as Mary Jo says, the big picture as God can, but I'm ready to do whatever he needs me to do. What I want to share with you tonight are some of the turning points in my life, and I think it's the people, places, events happen that cause a redirection. They cause me to think differently or make that change in direction. And those are the things that I'd like to share with you tonight. It really started for me in 1970. I was 12 years old at that time, and that year would set many, many patterns and directions for me that, of course, I can only see today looking back. But in the beginning of that year in January, my real parents decided to separate, and later they did divorce. Now, this wasn't really something that every parents were doing, but more and more people were getting divorced during that period of time, and so I decided that I'd live with my mother only because arrangements hadn't been made yet. And we didn't get along very well, but my new family, my new step family, I was becoming very close to. And in April of that year, I had my first drunk. Now, this was my stepsister Debbie's birthday party, but I was the one who really celebrated. I remember that first night very, very well. And it was a Friday night. And Fridays play very big parts in my life. I don't know why. I mean, it's a Friday night tonight. Dallas is on Friday. I got, you know, my home group's on Friday night. Fridays are very significant in my life as I look back and things happening. And it was on a Friday night that I had my first drunk. Now, if I had a drink prior to that, it was, you know, off of Daddy's Whiskey and Seven or something like that, but nothing, you know, that made bells go off. But this night, I had one objective, and that was to get drunk. And because the way I understood it from my peers is that they all drank, and that the ultimate was drunk. And gosh, you know, I'm going for the ultimate. I mean, I'm going for the whole package. Now, I knew you drank liquor to get there, but I just didn't know exactly what that felt like. But, God, they really talked about it favorably, so it was all right for me, too. And so the first night I did set my drinking pattern. It was, from the very first time, it was loss of control, because not one time did I say, no, thank you, I've had enough, I don't want to mix my drinks. I mean, it just didn't make a difference. It was more like, give me more, give me more, give me more. And it was alcohol, it was beer, it didn't make a difference. It was mixed or from the bottle or warm or on ice. It made no difference. But God, what it was doing to me was wonderful. I loved it. And also those little footballs that were starting to grow on the inside weren't there anymore. And I felt a part of, and I felt on their level with those cool people that I wanted to be like. And everything was all right. And I love that. I never forgot that. And, of course, I always went for that same feeling, that relief, that freedom, that fun. But that first night was for acceptance amongst my peers. But that night instilled for me that compulsion and that craving had begun in its smallest form. Of course, I wasn't at 12 a full-blown alcoholic. Obviously, after one drunk, it takes a little bit of practice. And so I was out to practice. And so it became a weekend thing for me. And about a year later, I was introduced to the wonderful world of drugs. And my main thing the last year and a half of my drinking was a bottle of whiskey and a hit or two of acid. I preferred that as a combination because I liked what whiskey did, but I also knew the blackout that would come, and this would help counteract it and keep me in consciousness long enough before the blackout would eventually happen. And so that's why I like to take the two together. But early, of course, it was just the beer and small liquor and stuff like that. Later that year, my father did remarry. And the tide turned the morning after they were married, and my stepmother and I basically started World War III in our own home. It wasn't the Brady Bunch. We didn't get into that kind of environment where everyone was loving and hi mom, hi dad sort of thing. It was a very stressful situation. And I had relief through alcohol and drugs. I got my relief. You know, those were not only a rough period of time as a budding alcoholic, but as an adolescent and major changes in my own personal life, and it was just too much. And so the alcohol and drugs would help me through these times. We, at the time, were living in a town called Huron, South Dakota, and had moved to Grafton, North Dakota, and the drinking really got bad there. It really became a daily thing. And I was just becoming wild. I mean, just, you know, late every night and lots of drinking and lots of partying and this sort of thing. And to me, the pain, you know, the hangovers, the sickness, that sort of thing, the little things were no price. I mean, I'd gladly pay them. You know, this was no consequence as far as I could see it. And I wasn't hurting anybody else. I was just having a good time. Well, about 5 years and 3 weeks after that first drunk in April of 70, I had a police escort to the hospital in Grand Forks to be committed for alcoholism and drug addiction. I was 17 at the time, And of course, you know, being in this hospital was a mistake. I mean, there's obviously some error made here because I'm too young to be an alcoholic. Come on, let's face it. I mean, you're saying I have a drinking problem and I'm an alcoholic and I'm not even of legal age to buy it yet. You know, there was some correlation in my mind there, but nobody else really paid any attention to that. And I learned very early that there's no preference to alcoholism. It doesn't make a difference where I've come from or been or finances or religion or sex or age. And it has no preference. But I did have this disease. In this treatment center, I learned lots of things. It was only a 4-week program, but just to be on the safe side, I stayed 7 weeks. Not because I was sicker than others, you know, but they just wanted to make sure I was okay to be released. And I was sort of an experiment. I mean, the hospital was 6 months old, and they wanted to see how adolescents recovered. And, of course, I was 17, and then the next age was like 35. And that's really a long, you know, difference when you're 17. And so I was sort of an experiment for them. But it was a very tiny group. And now I want to share a couple of the things that I learned there because I'm very grateful that I did have an opportunity to go through a hospital because I certainly wasn't ready to quit drinking the way I said. I mean, that wasn't my problem. That wasn't the problem. But it being there allowed me time to defog, to find alternatives, that there was a different way to live, that any drinking from this point on was a matter of choice, and not because I didn't know the difference. It was my choice now, not something that everybody did. Not everybody drank like I did because it was my only experience. That was what I assumed. Everybody drank like this. Everybody has blackouts and passes out. I mean, that happened my very first night, and I just didn't think anything differently. And so the way, you know, I'm grateful, and as I've heard it said often, is that treatment is discovery and AA is recovery. And my alliance and allegiance has been with Alcoholics Anonymous, but I'm very grateful that I had the opportunity to defog long enough to know that there was an alternative and that my recovery is in Alcoholics Anonymous. So in this hospital, which I went to in on a Friday night, we had, many of you are familiar with therapy and group programs and stuff like that. And the very first morning, I had my first group session. And there was about 10 of us, I suppose, in there. And we were each given a paper and pencil. And on one side, we were to write, I am, and 10 things. And then on the other side, I like, and 10 things. Well, you know, the only time I'd been given paper and pencil has been in a testing environment, and, you know, I didn't really know what to put down or anything. So I just told them the truth. You know, I didn't know what you wanted to hear, and I didn't have any education in this, so I just put the truth down. And so everybody wrote them up on the board, and they were all pretty dull. You know, they were, you know, I drank alone, and my family left me and my job, you know, and they were all kind of dull. But mine livened up the place a little bit. I, you know, told them the bars and I like drugs and drinking and all that sort of thing. But the two things that really sort of threw them off a little bit was I told them that I was an avid Hitler fan and that I practiced voodoo. And they asked me about that, and, you know, I didn't exactly tell them, but the way I looked at it is, you know, Hitler was a victim of circumstance, and it wasn't all his fault. Not that I agree with what he did, but you can't blame the guy for giving him a chance. And the other thing was, if you had a stepmother like I did, you would practice voodoo too. Now, I don't think that way about either issue anymore, but that's the kind of a mentality that I went in with. And he asked me one very simple question. And this was a big turning point for me because it also answered things very rapidly. And he said, what kind of a world do you live in? Is it real or is it fantasy? And I said, fantasy. And in those milliseconds that went by before my answer, I realized so many things, and they were, reality is my stepmother. And if that is reality, then you can have it. Because you're right, I don't know how to live there, and I don't want to know how to live there. And I don't want to be there. That is an unfun world. It's a painful world. It's a world that's just tense and hurtful. But you see, when I take alcohol and drugs, I'm going to this world over here, and I don't feel those footfalls. I don't feel so terrible, and things are okay. But apparently, because I'm here, and you say I have a problem, and I guess you're going to teach me how to live in this so-called reality without alcohol and drugs. I don't know if I'm really willing to do that. I don't know what I have to do, but I can listen. I wasn't very committed. I wasn't interested in stuff and drinking forever. I mean, that's the way I understood it. That's not the way it was said, it's the way I understood it. When you're 17 years old and you're looking at forever, that is a very long time. You know, your life's over. Your life is over if you can't drink anymore. I mean, that's the way you see it. When, I'm not going to have any fun anymore. What am I going to do on the weekends? That was a major question. What am I going to do on the weekends? You know, if I'm going to have to sit around and read books and pray all weekend, well, forget it. You know, I don't want to be dull. You know, I don't want to be, joining a convent somewhere. I'm not interested in that. If that's what you want me to do, then I'll go back. You know, I'd rather be out there drinking. But that isn't what they taught me. So every Friday night again, we would go be taken out to these meetings, bussed out to these meetings. No, we were still pretty little, so we had people come in their cars. And I'd be in the back row listening to the rock and roll band down the street while some old fart would be up here, you know, talking away. And, you know, I mean, again, that's the way I looked at things. I mean, we have nothing in common, bud, you know. You're old enough to be my grandfather. Yes, you belong here. You look like an alcoholic. You need to be here. I'm glad you got here in time. But it's almost a curse in a way to be young because you regain your health so quickly. You pop back up so quickly that nothing's wrong as far as you can tell on the outside. Now that, the inside unfortunately can't be seen, but you spring back up to life. But I would listen to those things and I would find everything different. Why I wasn't one of you. Why I wasn't an alcoholic. Why I wasn't bad enough yet. Even after I came into this program and I would hear stories, I would think, well, gosh, you know, it wasn't necessary for me to play the role of a hooker to support my habit. And all they would say to me is just add yet. Lots of things weren't necessary for me. I learned and was convinced or realized and finally had enough. I had hit my own personal bottom to realize that I don't need to continue to add to my story. Not in that sense. And so I'd hear these guys say how they'd lost their homes. You know, their families had left them. And the way I looked at it, well, I didn't really lose my family. Not in the sense they're talking about. When I left, it was just an overall mutual, unanimous consent that I leave. I was causing enough trouble, but that I could leave. They would talk about losing jobs. Well, of course, most of us learned how to quit first, you know, when we were coming very close to that stage. And if you considered school a job, which I didn't, I had been expelled 3 times my senior year and never did graduate with my class, although I did graduate. All drinking related, but that didn't count. That wasn't a job. I never got paid for that, so that didn't count. They would talk about cars, smashes and wrecks, and I'd only had fender benders. And never anybody in the car, just little dents now and then would happen. They talked about jails. I'd only been in 3 times, and those were all, you know, misunderstandings anyway, so that didn't count. The thing that I always enjoyed was when they would tell me they'd go on the wagon. I never could imagine what a wagon full of drunks must look like. I mean, that's the silliest expression I'd ever heard, you know, and I just, see, those kinds of things, going on the wagon, switching liquor from beer to alcohol, and that whole paragraph that the book talks about, or the things we try different, I guess I'm not quite as smart as everybody else, because it didn't occur to me to do those things, because it didn't occur to me that drinking was any problem. Now, it caused those problems, of course. I know that today. But it didn't at the time. And it just never occurred to me. I mean, I lied the same old stupid lie time after time. I was not creative with lying. I learned more about that as a result of coming to Alcoholics Anonymous than I ever did in my own experience. So I said, hey, I'm not like that. And again, they reminded me that I could just add the word yet, and I too could have those things come true in my life if I wanted to go back drinking. Well, I wasn't, yes, I took the first five steps, but I had reservations. I had doubts. Now, the fact sheet that had been drawn up for me says alcoholics do these kinds of things. They feel these kinds of things. They understand these kinds of things. But it didn't seem like that. This was me. It didn't seem like the same person. And so they decided that for further recovery, which really, even though I didn't want to admit it, I knew I needed it, they decided to send me to an all-women's halfway house in Minneapolis. Well, an all-women's halfway house didn't really get me excited. You know, it's if they would have suggested co-ed or all-men, I'd have been glad to go. But I went reluctantly, you know, this all-women's halfway house. And it's so on a Friday, I arrive at this halfway house. Bags in hand, I'm in a city that I've never been in before. I mean, this is huge compared to what I'm used to. And I go to this house, I don't know a soul, I'm terrified. I'm hot, and I walk in here, and I see these women moving quickly through this hallway, and they're hugging and kissing and curlers in their hair, and I thought, my God, they want me to go gay. And I just thought, my God, give me a break. You know, I mean, first no booze and no drugs, now no men. I mean, this is just a little too much to ask somebody in my condition. They didn't. That wasn't one of the prerequisites, thank goodness. But, and I don't mean to offend anybody either, but, that, you know, this was big stuff to me. I mean, I'm coming from small towns, and I barely heard about it, let alone have to maybe make the move in that direction. So I was very, very scared. And there were 40 women there, all total about, give or take a couple. And it was kind of, even though I didn't really break down all these walls with women, it helped me a lot, become friends, become acquaintances with women. And it's been over the years that I've actively worked on this part of my life. I always had some imaginary competition or race going on, and I was either better than you or less than you. And I just never could find that equal balance. And this really has taken some time, and now my women friends are very, very close to me, and they're a very, very important part of my life. But anyway, being at this halfway house, I was there for 7 months and before I went on a trip. Now, during these 7 months, I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to one meeting a month, and the only reason I went that often was because I had to get a piece of paper signed. But I'd go to one a month, and I'd kind of get full of strength for the next meeting. God, if I go 4 days without one, now I get squirrely. But I would go one a month, and I knew I would drink again, and I think this may have been my own little way of keeping distance, so that when I do go out there, because I know I will, I won't hurt you. You know, you won't be that close to me, and I won't hurt you. I was being good. I was being good because I didn't want to hurt my father anymore. I had already put him through enough pain that he didn't deserve to begin with, let alone put him through anymore. And so I wanted to be good. So I went on this trip to see my mother in California. I was out there 2.5 weeks. The first week I was absolutely miserable because when I was back running with my old cronies, I wanted to drink and drug with them. The last week and a half was worse because I did. And the worst part about it, or the best part about it, however you look at it, was the fact that it was so, the alcohol and drugs didn't do it anymore. Something had happened. I realized today what had happened is I had too much Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd been to too many meetings in those 7 months that it wasn't fun anymore. AA will ruin your drinking. There's no doubt it will ruin your drinking. And I kept trying to say, well, if only I was at my old playgrounds, and only if I was with my old playmates, if only, it would be different. And it wasn't. I knew it wouldn't be different. I mean, I tried the same amounts and quantities and brands and everything. And I couldn't create that anymore. And what happened is I saw alcoholism in me. And I saw in a confirmed state loss of control and all those other symptoms, the denial of this disease of alcoholism. I saw that. And so I returned home thinking, well, that was 2,000 miles ago as I enjoyed Western champagne flight home. See, these two women next to me didn't know that I shouldn't be drinking, right? So I might as well enjoy it while I can. But the problem was, is I knew it. So I decided, okay, you know, I've learned my lesson now. And that's how I looked at it. I learned my lesson. And so I upped my meetings from one a month to one a week. And that was, that was progress. And, 5 weeks later, I got a letter in the mail on a Friday. And in that letter was a lump, and that lump was one joint. Now, I'd never really cared for pot. It was messy. You had to have all this paraphernalia. It was stinky, and, you know, it just took a lot of effort. Just give me some pills, and let's move. You know, that's the way I like to take, you know, used to do things. And I really didn't know what to do with this one joint. Now, I know this is a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, but this played a very important part because I am free of everything, and this includes any drugs that I ever took. And this was in February, and I thought for an hour, I debated for an hour what to do with this one joint. And so like any good, sick alcoholic, I decided to keep it just in case I needed to take the edge off or, you know, I had a bad day or something like that. And that someday became the next day on Saturday. And I thought, I'm going to make it just like it used to be. It's a warm Saturday afternoon, and I'm going to make it just like it used to be. And I smoked that joint, and the thing of it was, is it did for me what nobody and nothing had ever been able to do before. The mental battle couldn't be stopped. There was all this battle going on. You know you shouldn't. It's always the first drink or first pill or first drug that gets you going. You know, you should be at a meeting, call your sponsor, I don't have one, who needs one? You know, that kind of thinking would be going on. And the inner battle was worse than anything. But what it did is it got me off the ground enough to where I wasn't in control 100% anymore, but not enough to kill all these thoughts going on in my mind and the terrible feelings in my gut about me and about everything else. But mostly about me, mostly the self-disgust. And so I decided, well, I was trying to find my car that afternoon. I had lost it in a shopping center. I was roaming the parking lot, and as I was looking for it, God and I had a very long discussion. And I said, I've had it. I have had it. And I can't live like this anymore. And I knew something was different. I knew that I wasn't feeling I'm going to prove it to you. I'm going to be good. I'm going to show you I can do it. It wasn't that kind of feeling at all. It was, I really don't want to live this way anymore for me. And I know where I need to go. I knew it was Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, many people ask me or hope that I have some answer as to how do you get through to somebody young? And I don't have an answer, but my own experience for me and with working with other young people, whatever that may be, is we do it the same way you do it with anybody else. You plant the seeds. We drop those seeds. We let them know that there's an opportunity, that they don't have to live this way anymore, that there is a place to get help, just like you do with any other drunk. And because that's what had happened for me. I just hadn't come to my own decision yet of what I wanted to do with this deal. And finally, on that day, God and I got together and I knew where the direction was. And I haven't had anything since that time. And that's a little over 9 years ago. What I did is I immediately went to the old timers. And through the years, they have become and are very, very special people to me. And I've had some of, in my opinion, some of the very finest teachers. I've had great men and women in my life as my teachers and as my examples. And I still have many of them in my life today. I got involved. They would give me little jobs to do, and sobriety was meetings every day. You know, totally different. I wanted to go. It was time, and I wanted to change. This was what happened. I wanted to change. I was willing to go to any length. That was the question. Are you? Yes. About 6 months into recovery, two things happened. I was questioning about God. Now, I knew there was a God. He was up in the clouds and he had a great big white beard and all this stuff, and I'd been raised Catholic. But I wasn't raised of a punishing God of hellfire and brimstone. I wasn't raised to be afraid of him or anything. I'm very grateful for that because I know a lot of people have said that they've had to relearn and forget and then teach themselves again or learn again. And I didn't have to do that, but I had called on him and made so many deals with him in the past that I just didn't know if I was worthy enough to ask him to be in my life anymore or if he would even help me if I was just supposed to pay the penalty, you know, and just do it on my own. But what I was more afraid of was if I got a little too believing, you know, and I would end up start passing out pamphlets, you know, on street corners and wearing flowers and stuff, you know. I was more worried about that than going this way. And that kind of answered for me at a convention, and I went there on a Saturday night to hear the speakers for the first time that I'd ever been in a convention. I'd always gone for fun and fellowship, you know, I like that too. But I went to hear the message, and that was on my mind, I'm going to hear the message. And Saturday night, a man named Eddie from Southern California talked, and he cried in front of 5,000 people, and he moved me and touched me in places in my heart that I didn't even know were there. And I saw in him emanating some sort of an aura. And I realized that that must be what God is like when he's on the inside. And I want that. I want to get that. I'd like to find out how you get there. And over the next few years, I got to know Eddie, correspondence, and we'd see each other around the country and telephone and so forth. And Eddie became a very, very dear person to me, and he taught me an awful lot. During that time, I got very involved in Alcoholics Anonymous and really became a part of. I was involved in many committees and conventions and stuff, and I needed to be. That was where I was most alive. I just really came to life when I was a part of AA. And in my third year, just shortly after my third birthday, I had gone out for a weekend to a convention and came back to find that one of my old-timers had died. Now, he was dying of cancer, and we knew that, and it was on Easter weekend. And he had died. And 2 weeks later, I was getting ready on a Friday night to go out to a meeting, and I had a call that Eddie had died. And this was very tough for me because, you see, I was supposed to see him in a month, and I just didn't want to believe that I wasn't going to be able to, and I didn't want to believe that this had happened. And because you had taught me, no matter what, you know, we don't stop living, we keep on going, I went on to the meeting that night. And God, you know, he's just so wonderful to me. His timetable and his movements are always perfect. And I showed up at this meeting I had never been to, and there were 5 members from my home group who were there who had never been to that meeting before either. And they helped me through that meeting, and I returned home, and I had a different kind of conversation with God. I was very upset with him. And I let him know. And the conversation went something like this. You know, I know, who am I, right, to ask you? But I'm very upset that you've taken Eddie now. I'm very upset that now I can't see him anymore and I can't call him. And now why couldn't you just wait a month? Why couldn't you just wait a little bit? Because I really miss him. I really miss him. And you see, because I always forget that these people are humans. They're mortal, that I'm mortal. And so what happens is, okay, you know, I don't like it, it's obvious, but can you just sort of help me through tonight? Teach me something. I mean, what is my lesson here? What help me get in a different thinking path. And nothing, you know, magical happened. But what did happen, and this is the way he works for me, is it was just a gradual change of feeling, a gradual relief, a gradual change of thinking, that two things came out of that for me. One, make the time with the people that you love quality versus quantity. Don't be concerned about how much, but make it very quality time. And the other thing was, Deb, learn how to really live one day at a time. Make each day count. Make each day make its mark in your life. And I've tried to do that. That's been a very big lesson. I haven't always done it. But those have been two of the things that I think about in the mornings when I'm preparing for the day, is to do these kinds and have this kind of an attitude, to make it quality day and make it a full day. Well, shortly after that, I moved to Atlanta shortly before my fourth birthday. And Atlanta has been a new chapter in my life. Let me tell you, I've had many chapters unfold while in Atlanta. I was about 6 years sober. It was just after my 6 year. And on a Friday night, I met a fellow. And it had been building in me in the sense of, I think changes happen around that fifth and sixth year, thinking-wise, you know, and I've known many people have experienced that, too. And it happened to me, too. And it's, you know, sick thinking. You just don't wake up one morning and decide, well, I think I'll do some sick behavior today. I mean, you don't think like that. You know, it's so gradual that it just sneaks up closely on you. And this is what happened to me. I met a fellow who had been sober 13 years. And he had a lot of money. He was a good-looking guy. He was the age of guys I liked to date. He was single. And, gee, this is wonderful. Now, the thing is he hadn't been going to meetings for the past 3 years. He'd been busy making money. And I liked money, too. And I thought, well, now, isn't this great? You know, everything will just work out really grand. I mean, he'll want to go to meetings with me, and I'm just a great vehicle, you know, for this guy to get back into it. Well, I know he went to two meetings, and but that wasn't his primary purpose. You know, I mean, I was very involved in this relationship. Now, he wasn't, but I was very involved in it, and there was quite a romance going on in my mind. There was big deals going on. But what happened is, if you had replaced him with the bottle, you would have found my exact behavior 6 years earlier. Because what was happening is that I would go where he was going to be. I would dress for that occasion. I would be home all night if he said he was going to call. My day could be an elation or a depression depending on the call. And that is a terrible way to live. And I was so dependent on a person to create that happiness within that I just wasn't able to generate it. I just really felt if we could get this deal together, I'll get him an AA and he can buy me lots of nice things, then everybody will be happy. And especially me, because I want things. I'm into the power and the prestige and stuff now. And it just wasn't working according to plan. And the worst thing of it was, and this was the real sickness, part of me realized this and knew what was happening. The other part of me didn't want to do anything about it. Because I would sit there in the mirror and I would tell myself that his unacceptable behavior to me was okay, that I should be more understanding. Well, if I'd have gotten more understanding, I'd have had about a zero IQ. I mean, I couldn't have been more understanding. I was an absolute jerk, you know, hanging around waiting for this guy, hoping he would change someday. But it was always going to be different. He won't stand me up again, and he would. And finally, I just had to let him go because he got married. shortly thereafter, he started to drink, and you see what happens when you didn't stick around me. So anyway. Anyway, I just found me another one like that, and I married him off 3 months later, too. So, after two of these incidents, I decided that maybe I had better sort of step out of the way. Since I wasn't having great success in the men relationships in my life, maybe God could do a little bit better. And I decided that, yeah, I'm ready to change. You see, I knew if I wanted to change, if I didn't want to feel this way anymore, that meant change. And change meant facing reality, something I had been really out of for about 8 months. And so in October of that year, I went to a convention. I went to be in the audience and to listen very carefully to the message. Once again, I'm asked the question, are you willing to go to any length? And yes, I am. That question to date has always been an affirmative. And I went down there and I heard exactly what I needed to hear, as I knew I would. And I was very open. And I heard two things. I heard, people, places, and things don't make me happy. Now, I've heard that a jillion times. Never paid much attention to it. Never really understood it for some reason. It just wasn't clicking. And this guy was talking about, in his drinking, that he realized that people, places, and things don't make me happy. And I'm thinking, God, I'm talking right now today, sobriety at 6.5 years. People, places, and things don't make me happy. But my words changed a little bit, and what was appropriate for me was men, money, and mansions don't make me happy. Now, I'm certainly not against all those things. There's nothing wrong with them. They're, you know, one or all together. But the way I wanted to abuse them in my life was, you see, I wanted to be humbly wealthy. And that was what I wanted to be. And that wasn't what I was going to be. That wasn't what God had planned for me. And so I realized that this area of my life is something that I really have no business doing anything with that. But God will provide these people in my life when I'm ready for them. And I have other things to do right now. So the other thing I heard was, take care of family business now. God, okay, as soon as he said that, in the back of my own little closet, I heard the skeleton clanging back there. And that skeleton's little name tag said stepmother. Now, I had never made amends to my stepmother on purpose. I mean, I knew she was there. I mean, I hadn't forgotten or anything. But I had never been to the point of where I could make amends to her and not think so strongly in the back of my mind, you better give me one too. I mean, you were really crappy to me. You know, I couldn't do it for me. To clean the wreckage of my own past. And throughout that weekend, to the time I got home, the thinking went along the lines of, my gosh, she's back in my life again. Do you think I could? I'm thinking about making an amend to her. Do you think I can? I think I need to. And if I don't, it's going to haunt me until I do. And I think I want to make amends, and I am going to make amends. And so I went back, and I started back at the steps again. And I did a 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And for Christmas that year, I made a 9th step amend to my stepmother for me. And that gave me the freedom of the wreckage of my past. And that really, I felt very, very good about that. I lived on that high of feeling brand new, fresh, cleaned up in the past for about a year. And then, a little after my 8th year, all of a sudden, there wasn't much activity going on in my life, and I wasn't participating quite as much. And I was not sticking around the meetings long, and, oh, God, I've heard that speaker many times, you know, and I wouldn't go as often, and my ears were becoming closed again. And I wasn't becoming very happy. I was very restless and irritable and discontent. And I've experienced that a lot during my sobriety. And it's what you get, what you put into it. And I wasn't putting a whole lot into it. And so that summer it became really bad, and I became very lonesome. And I'd felt lonesome before, but it was like no big deal. I know this passes, it goes away in 2-3 days. But this was dragging on, and it was really getting obnoxious, and it was getting boring to feel like this all the time. And I was getting very restless. And even if somebody had been brought into my life, the poor guy wouldn't have had a chance. I mean, nobody could have filled that, because that's what wasn't what needed to be filled in my life. And I would demand that God remove this right now. And, you know, nothing would happen. I mean, he doesn't work like that in my life. When I start demanding and giving direction, it just doesn't work like that for me. I I'd call people, and I would, I just all felt blue. And finally, in late September, I went down to a convention, and it was sort of like an emergency convention where I ran down the last minute and got with my people that were coming in and got filled up, knowing that I was okay not to be married at 27, and, you know, I wouldn't have to worry about old maid doom and all that sort of thing. And it was just, you know, like Donna Harris says, she says, God was getting him ready for me. And I have clung to that statement so many times. Thank goodness she said that, and I believed it, but gee, you know, they say it hits you when you're not looking, but, you know, I was kind of going around peeking all the time, and I just, you know, if he went by, I didn't want to miss him. You know, I just was afraid I'd miss him if I wasn't watching. And so I came back, and I had made lots of decisions. Well, there's some things that I want to do, and I'm going to do to make some changes, because I know these will create results. And they did. They created results. And I became very happy and fun being single. And God, my life just took off again. And I was that was on Sunday. But let me tell you what happened Monday night. Sunday night when I had gotten home, I got a phone call from the first guy that I had married off. And I thought, I got off the phone and thought, my God, he's back in my life again. Well, maybe he was supposed to be there all this time, and maybe you're bringing him back for me now, right? And I thought, well, I'll just kind of investigate this a little bit. So we had dinner Monday night, and after 10 minutes, I knew there was no way that I was interested in a long-term anything with this bozo, and that that the real message that I was supposed to get that night from him was he'd been sober a year and a half. And the message for me was what I was missing. I saw in him that new sobriety of helping other people, of picking people up and taking them to meetings, of helping these folks in treatment centers go to their lawyers or libraries or whatever they needed to do. And that's what I saw. And I thought, now look at me. I'm a pitiful looking mess here. I'm supposed to know better. I'm not supposed to feel these kinds of stupid things like this deep loneliness and feeling like a newcomer again. I'm not supposed to blah, blah, blah. But I was. I was feeling those things. And he showed me, as another member, that I didn't have to live like that. And so I went home, and when I got on my knees to pray that night, I went into a half-hour crying jag, and it was the first bit of relief I'd had in a long time. And I didn't want to stop, and I couldn't stop. And I got done, and I felt like somebody else. I felt a great relief. And I just knew that whatever you want me to do, I'll do it. In November, and that's when my life took off. In November, I went to a conference. I told some friends of mine there, I'm ready. I mean, wherever God wants me to go, whatever he wants me to do, whoever he brings into my life, I'm ready. You know, and they said, well, sometimes when you're ready, you just sit back and be patient. And about a month later, on a Friday night, I met a fellow, and we had our first date on a Friday night. This fellow was, I've learned more from this guy in three, four months than I could learn from four people. I learned an awful lot of things about the disease of alcoholism and drug addiction. And here I am with almost 9 years at the time that I met him. He'd been off cocaine 2 months, hadn't been drinking, had wanted to change his life, and I'm just, you know, boy, isn't this great? I mean, he's cute, he's a young fella, he's working hard, he's trying to put himself back together, shows interest, he wants to better his life, and what a perfect vehicle I am for him. So we had 6 weeks of great time. It was just heaven on earth as far as I was concerned. And a Friday night, he picked up a drink. And the whole thing changed. And I always felt it would get back to where it was. I always felt from his words that he would take the actions he was saying. But he never did. And so what happened is he ended up having to go back to his drug of choice of cocaine. And it affected my life greatly. It affected me in a fear of my own life. It affected me emotionally terribly. I cared very, very deeply for him. I saw alcoholism in its active sense right in front of me, and I was so powerless. He had the greatest people that I, some of the greatest people I know, available with outstretched hands, waiting to help him, but he couldn't seem to make the connection. And it became a very involved matter. And I learned a great deal. I learned that I cannot fix you. I cannot fix him. As much as I loved him and as much as I cared for him, I really had to give him back to God. I had provided and shown all vehicles and all opportunities, that I could not do it for him. I couldn't create the desire within him to want to do it as much as I would had hoped and prayed for. As a result of this, I learned a great deal of about responsibility, about responsibility that I have to Alcoholics Anonymous. A little over a year ago, when my sponsor gave me my 8th anniversary chip, he said, "Here stands the future of Alcoholics Anonymous." And it hit me strongly, my personal responsibility as a whole of the unity of Alcoholics Anonymous was very great. But these old-timers do go to the big meeting in the sky, and they do maybe move away from your physical area, and that it is up to me as one of the many up-and-coming and new in sobriety to make sure that it's intact. You know, this year we celebrate our 50th anniversary, and what a thrill this is for me to be a part of a great movement as Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know and feel that if I keep doing what I'm doing, and if I keep listening to my teachers and following the program and living the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, that maybe I can keep it strong for another 50 years as you have done for me. Thank you.